Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Hank. I sense I was making you a little anxious. You kept waving at me to make sure I was focused and ready to...
Well, that always happens when I don't take an active part in setting up the microphones and all the wires and things, which I didn't today.
But I was ready today.
Okay, good.
Absolutely and, ready today and happy to be here.
Plus, I'm a little depressed because I had a wonderful weekend and it's always sad to come back to the real world.
I know, and why is that? You know, I think we've done a show about post-vacation syndrome, that there's a huge dip we go into. After any big, wonderful life event, there's that depression that follows and how difficult it is to get back to work and back into the routine. And the sad part is that we hold that sadness. We don't tell anybody because we feel guilty that we had a vacation and then we're coming back and say, I had the best vacation. Now I feel lousy being here. And your coworker, you know, who hasn't even been to the fair in 5 years. So really, you're going to complain about that? But I like your new shoes.
Oh, thank you. Went to San Francisco, got new shoes.
And best sight that you saw?
Well, the reason we went up there, my wife's son just graduated from Le Cordon Bleu Culinary Academy. And so we're very proud of him for that. So that was the main event. He graduated, but we managed to get in a lot more fun. No specific site. I just like the food and the drink and the shopping and the whole electric atmosphere of the city.
Yeah, not quite San Luis Obispo.
Not exactly.
but almost as much traffic as we have now. We're mimicking the Bay Area.
The traffic was crazy. The San Francisco Marathon was going on. The big freeway series between the Giants and the A's was going on. Right. And it was just all sorts of hubbub.
Well, I'm glad you had a good time.
Thank you.
And I will support and hold your blueness for a day or two till you find your way back.
Okay, thank you.
The nice thing is we get to come back here, and this is a great place to be. And I'm happy to have you tune in every Tuesday and be part of this conversation. The next couple weeks are going to be interesting because we're focusing on the topic of marriage. And it's interesting because we always talk about marriages and relationships in some sort, but we're kind of focused in on maybe the darker sides of marriage. They were talking about the end of marriages and divorce and kind of the journey through the ending of a marriage and what that can be like as we enter into this dark unknown and then trying to find our way out the other side. And then next week, we're going to follow up with a conversation about the recent breach of the website Ashley Madison. If you're not familiar with it, it's a website about looking for affairs, setting up affairs for married people. And there was a breach in their confidentiality or their privacy. And so now these names of people that are signed up on the site are being leaked. And so I thought it'd be interesting to talk about infidelity and what role it plays in marriage. What role do these trysts outside of marriage play in our relationships? How do we get to that spot? Because you might be surprised to know that infidelity really isn't considered a deal breaker in marriages, that it's not really considered one of the top three reasons for divorce. So next week, we're going to kind of move into that conversation, and I'm looking forward to it. But today, I actually have a guest in the studio, and I found out about this woman because she came to town and has written a book and is setting up her life here, and she's sharing her story about her journey through a near-death divorce, she calls it, where she saw the end of her 17-year marriage abruptly happen and was unprepared for life on her own and taking care of herself and dismantling of that identity that she had in that marriage. And then finding her way, I think she would say crawling her way belly first through the process of healing and finding herself where she is today, sitting in my studio. So, Patty Blue Hayes, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are going to talk about your book, Wine, Sex, and Suicide, My Near-Death Divorce, that you just recently self-published through mm-hmm. Amazon.
Yes.
And it's written journal style, so I did read through it, and I almost felt a little bit guilty because you're so raw and honest in what you write. I feel like I actually stumbled upon your journal in your home and started reading it. It's so raw.
Yes.
And so I appreciate you coming in and taking the time to share your story and to talk about this experience with divorce. And as always, we're going to open up the conversation to hear your thoughts and ideas, questions, or comments. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of the conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or on our website, thereluctanttherapist.com, and previous shows are always available at kcbx.org. And we are tweeting, although I forgot to tweet today because it is not in my normal repertoire of activities yet. But we do have a Twitter account, and it's at EBTRT. So if tweeting is part of your daily activity, you can follow us, and I'll be posting shows and information along the way. And you can always email me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com if there's something you want to ask and are a little concerned about going on the air about. All right. So, Patty, not quite sure where to start because your story is so rich and full of information. But why don't we start with a little bit about the end point, that here you are in San Luis Obispo and you moved here when?
3.5 years ago.
3.5 years ago from Los Angeles.
From Los Angeles.
And it was from reading the back of the book forward. This was kind of your do-over after the divorce was final, was coming up to San Luis Obispo.
The divorce actually wasn't final until after I think I moved up here. Mm-hmm. But it became clear that I couldn't afford to keep the house on my own where I was living. And I was very attached to the house. And I kind of had a pull from within me to leave Los Angeles and to come up here where it was a little quieter, a little more peaceful. I took a few road trips up and just imagined myself living a quieter, peaceful life. And I did have friends tell me, just try it for a year. You can always come back to Los Angeles, because making those kind of life changes, they feel so permanent, and already on the heels of heartbreak and feeling devastated and in despair, it was challenging to pack up a house that I loved. I was very attached to it. And to start over.
Mm-hmm. So you're here in San Luis Obispo, and what does your new life look like?
Well, it was a process getting to where I am.
We'll talk about it. I kind of want to get to the end, but like, where have you found yourself? And then we'll backtrack to how the story unfolded. But where you found yourself here, and you support yourself writing, or?
Well, the writing does not know. most authors will tell you, no. I am doing coaching, and I want to help women get through that heartbreak process. And I have a program that I'm trained in where actually I'm going to be presenting that to Transitions Mental Health Agency. It's called Infinite Possibilities, and it's a personal empowerment program.
So you've kind of now, at the end of the story that we're going to tell, have found yourself in a pretty good place.
Yes, most days. And then that's part of the process, is understanding it's fine to feel lonely sometimes. You know, each Christmas that passes, each anniversary date, each birthday, each season that something might be a reminder, it's okay to feel the feelings. And that's one thing that I did not do during my whole process of avoid, numb, and deny. I then learned to feel, express, and release. Mm-hmm. And that feelings and emotions aren't permanent, and they do flow, they're fluid, but it's allowing ourselves to actually feel that. So now, if I'm feeling sad, I allow myself to feel sad. It's not that I'm supposed to be, you know, happy and awesome and amazing 100% of the time, every day. That's just not natural. It's not normal life. It's not part of the human experience.
Well, it's funny because last week I did the show about the movie Inside Out, and that was the topic of conversation was about how little we understand about our feelings, emotions, and moods, and that it took something like an animated film to break it down to this very kind of simple understanding about how the emotional system works. And it is unfortunate that it took you going through this and having to go through a training or finding some sort of program that you felt had answers for you to actually move beyond this, that these skills of healing through grief, right, experiencing grief, those were never taught to you as a young person, as they're not taught to anyone in our culture. And it's unfortunate that your story is not an uncommon story of how people deal with grief and loss and transition and devastation. And I hope we'll have time to talk about that also, that we are woefully unprepared as a society to help people to deal with, understand, and trust their emotional world. So let's start off with what inspired you to share your story. What happened in your life?
The desire to write a book was born within me when I was a little girl. And specifically, I envisioned myself writing a book that would help adults. And I think it was at the time where my parents were going through some of their issues. So I kind of probably felt some adult issues that maybe a lot of other kids weren't feeling. And life gave me a lot of experiences that I could have written about and shared about, and I didn't. And then when I was sitting at the airport after learning that the infidelity had happened, the marriage was over, a voice just dropped in and said, pick up a pen. This is going to be your story. I didn't know what the story was going to be day to day. We could have gotten back together. Who knows what the story would have been? But I just wanted to start writing and start documenting. And then it was a process to decide to share because it is very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, I have no one left to be fearful of judgment because so much family fell away that I feel like this was my purpose to share this raw, vulnerable story. I wouldn't have been able to publish this if my parents were still alive. And then who knows if I'd even gone, would have experienced half of what I went through. But I think that this was kind of my sole purpose to do this.
So let's talk about your story. What happened in your life that became your book?
Well, I was born.
Well, maybe start with the more current piece about your marriage.
The part where I feel like we had a very good relationship. We got married after 10 years of dating. And then it seemed to me, that things kind of went downhill fairly quickly, maybe in a matter of a couple of years. But in hindsight, I can look back and actually see that when we started dating, I was attracted to him to fill an empty and lonely place within myself. That's a huge issue. As I know now, that's not a good way to start a relationship. When we feel incomplete, when we don't feel whole, when we don't feel fulfilled, if we're looking outside of ourselves for a person, a place, a car, a job, whatever it is, to fill us up.
I wonder if that's always true, though. Because if you think of people who, you know, find someone to get married, we talk about finding in that other person those things that complete us. Like, I don't know if it's always true that anyone is a whole human who marries another whole human. I mean, I think most of us in most times in our life are three quarters whole. And I think that is one of my concerns about the therapy language, is that we tell people you can't love someone until you love yourself, and you can't have a relationship until you're whole, because I think that's the process of our life, is that we're always discovering. I mean, so I can understand that you were trying to fill this place in you, but not necessarily that having that need was bad. That's when we look for relationships. It seems like maybe the person that we get in the relationship with isn't capable of fulfilling that, you know, piece, or we stop growing in some way. And I think that's usually where we get in trouble, is that we think, I found this person, now I'm safe and whole, and I can stop growing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I worry. I don't want anyone listening to think, oh my gosh, I'm not worthy of love unless I fully love myself, because I think that's a challenge that most people struggle with. And if we tell ourselves I'm unworthy of loving until I fully love myself, there's gonna be a lot of really lonely people.
I suppose. I'm actually now at, I mean, I really believe that self-love is the first love. And that only by loving myself and only by treating myself with respect and kindness and appreciation will I then attract a person who treats me that way as well. Because who is in my life is a reflection of how I see myself.
True.
And I think that's part of where the issues in the relationship really started to take a slide down was we both agreed that I was worthless. And so I felt worthless, and I felt that I was being treated as if I were a worthless person. But had I been stronger, had I had a stronger sense of self, had I had confidence, assuredness, healthier self-esteem, I don't think that I would have attracted or tolerated the treatment that I felt that I was getting.
Absolutely.
So I am a huge proponent of self-love.
Well, and I'm not an anti-self-love. I just would hate everyone to get stuck in the self-loathing space that just begets itself, right? That we keep saying, I don't love myself enough. No one can love me. I think there's a piece of that. I see myself as being loved by someone, and that helps me to grow and
yes, because
flourish.
We all want connection and companionship.
Well, and you and I talked a little bit also before we were on the air that those that what we get in our family of origin, right? What we're not or what we don't get in our family of origin growing up quite often impacts who we choose in our life. And so if you're a child of divorce and they think you came from a child of divorce background and kind of wanting the father issue or, you know, loss of mother, whatever those pieces are that we don't get when we're young, we can see how that impacts us when we go into our adulthood and the choices that we make. And, you know, not everyone is fortunate enough to come from a family that fills and nurtures every need we have. No parents really can fill and nurture every need a child has. But I think you came from a situation that was so kind of bereft of those filling experiences that you were in search of something that would make you feel whole.
Yes, yes. And my issues have issues because I was because I was adopted. And so that does layer on a whole other set of issues or circumstances to deal with. And I have felt that throughout my life, I've always been longing for family and longing to belong and felt like I had these very fractured experiences. And not that I never felt like I was unwanted. I felt very lucky that I was given up for adoption, had a chance to have a life, and was raised by a loving family. But it is fact that that was a fractured beginning experience. You know, the genetic biological bond was fractured. I never got to know, well, I did eventually get to meet that family, but growing up, I didn't know them. I didn't have them. Then when my parents got divorced, that's another fractured family. So when I met my future husband, he had this awesome family that filled that void. It was the, you know, searching, like, I found the Norman Rockwell family. This is amazing and wonderful. And then what happened when he and I get divorced? That loss just became even more magnified because I'd placed so much value and importance on that.
If you just tuned in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest in the studio today is Patty Blue Hayes, and we're talking a bit about her experience going through a near-death divorce, as she calls it, her experience with wine and sex and suicide. And we're going to talk about her process of how she healed after a very dark detour through behaviors that I'm sure she wishes hadn't been true. And we are going to open the phone lines to your calls, 805-781-3875, if you have any questions or comments for Patty or myself, and we welcome you into the conversation. So we started off already going down a tangent, which I knew we would, because your story is so compelling. But so you married this man, you live together for 10 years, you get married, and then 7 years you're married. But you see, the last 2 years, things started to falter a little bit. And so how does the divorce become the conversation? What happened to instigate the end of the marriage?
It was a pretty fast initiation. We had gone to some counseling, and I was under the impression that if I changed, if I admired him more, if I respected him more, if I cleaned the house better, if I did all these things, that we'd get back to the way we were, because that's what was being told to me that he needed. And I got confusing and mixed signals. And I think I also didn't really clearly see and understand the facts of what my situation was. And we both were abusing alcohol. So you add in that chemical component, and that can throw everything off. The divorce came very swiftly because there was a discovery of infidelity, and he confessed, and the first words out of his mouth were so clear, so very, very clear, I don't think we should be married anymore. And it landed so deeply within the pit of my stomach, because for 2 years or 2.5 years, everything felt very unclear. Mm-hmm. I didn't
like
know.
You had a sense that something was off?
I knew the stuff was off. Mm-hmm. I believed a lot of it was me or my doing or not doing, or that he was stressed at work because he worked long hours. And so I didn't really see the clear picture. And then when he uttered those words, it was super clear. Very, very clear.
So did you feel in that moment, oh, this is really done?
Yeah, I knew it was over. I knew it was over. And there was no, other than one very brief conversation. In fact, after that night, we were on vacation. We were at a wedding. And this was at the festivities before the wedding was happening. I happened to grab his phone. He wouldn't put the passcode in. You know, time passes and those words are spoken. And I look back now and I think, oh my God, he made me wait 4 days to even have a conversation about the end of the marriage. He never called the next day to make sure I got home okay. There was no text. There was no phone call. Now, when I look back, I think how unbelievably cold that is. But at the time, it seemed normal. It seemed like that was just part of how our relationship had devolved mm-hmm. into this lack of communication, this lack of warmth and compassion and caring and love and all those things that you would hope that would be in your relationship.
And it sounds like, in having read the book, that you were very happy to have created what you hoped was a Norman Rockwell family mm-hmm. with his family and with your life with him. And you kind of grew up from being in a rented apartment and small jobs, and his job got bigger and your life got bigger. And you kind of were living your dream life. Mm-hmm. And I can see how his behaviors, his pulling away, would go unnoticed, because I think you were so blissfully ensconced in your day-to-day life that you would kind of maybe ignore the way things had changed.
Yeah, and to be honest, I was kind of distracted by the shiny, sparkly mm-hmm. trappings of the life that we had. And we entertained a lot at one point. You know, it kind of grew to be entertaining a lot, and we moved away from going for the nice hikes together alone in the forest. And then when I would mention, let's go, you know, for a hike in the forest, it was just met with, no, I want to go somewhere else and go to a sports bar. And I just gave up a lot of my interests, the interests that we had together. And I enjoyed being the supporting role. I enjoyed being a wife. I loved being a wife. I loved ironing. I've never met anybody else who actually enjoys ironing. And I did. I loved all of that. I loved keeping the house. I loved cooking. I loved taking care of him and getting the snacks and doing all those things. And that's where I lost all sense of self. Who was I? The therapist that I was seeing said to me at one point, you know, that was a role that you played as wife. And I didn't understand that. I could not understand those words, because I identified so 100% as being, I am a wife, mm-hmm. not wife is my role.
So once the words were spoken and you felt the end had happened, what was the response? I'm assuming that you did not get up the next morning and go for a jog and go see your therapist and, you know, carry on. Sounds like it got a little dark.
It got very dark. And I wanted to get through it so desperately from the beginning. I wanted to be done with it, actually. I didn't want to go through it. And I think that's part of our culture. We don't like pain. I mean, that's part of being human, is we want to avoid pain and seek pleasure. So I very quickly wanted to fast forward through and be the whole, healed, balanced, new person. Mm-hmm. And I had some good things put in place, but because of the alcohol abuse, I had this, you know, chemical addiction going on, and to numb the pain, that was kind of my MO, to use the alcohol to numb pain. There's a lot of pain mm-hmm. when the end of the marriage came. And so it just became too easy to use that. I didn't consider, you know, quitting and stopping altogether, because I couldn't even fathom stopping. That would have been too painful.
Mm-hmm. To have nothing to
protect have nothing you. to absolve that pain. And I, at one point, had set out to, because I knew I was going to be writing a book, I said, let me do something positive and do volunteer work as a means of healing my broken heart, and I'll write about that. And hopefully by doing these positive things for other people and being of service, I will heal. By day, I'm working at kitchens and shelters and tutoring homeless children, and then by night, it was just so dark and bleak, so I would overdrink. And then a really bizarre addiction that showed up was a sexual addiction. I'd been faithful in my marriage and hadn't had sex with anybody else for 17 years. And all of a sudden, I felt like, I've never done heroin, but I felt like a heroin addict going to that part of town to score a fix. It was bizarre. That shocked me.
That you were capable of.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was just so strange. I mean, it makes sense to me now to think, well, it was from this very empty place, wanting to feel validated as a female because I'd been rejected and there was infidelity. And that just set off the good chemicals in the brain and the bonding. And I, you know, just missing having someone to lay next to. It didn't matter that they were strangers. It was just having, you know, that physical companionship even. And I remember at one point, you know, saying to my friend who came to stay with me, you know, where are all the decent guys? Where are all the good guys? And thinking to myself, Patty, you are lost and broken beyond repair. I'm not going to be attracting a decent, you know, whole human being, because I wasn't that myself. And yet the people that I was kind of bringing into my bedroom were just as broken and lost as I was. And we had that common bond, which actually did feel supportive in a strange way. It was a very odd time. I never anticipated being a 47-year-old woman with a sexual compulsion.
And fueled by the pain and heartache and devastation of your marriage ending mm-hmm. and facing having to start a life over again. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is Patty Blue Hayes, and we're talking about her experience through a lot of wine, a lot of sex, and a suicide attempt.
Yes.
That seemed to be kind of, I don't know if it was a catalyst, but it seemed at that moment that there was a lot of alarm bells that went on for you. And if you'd like to be part of our conversation, 805-781-3875 is the number to call in with your comments or questions. We'd love to hear from you. So Patty, it sounds like that you were living kind of dichotomous worlds where you felt, I'm going to go give service that'll help me get outside of myself. I'll volunteer. I'll do good for others. You're kind of a little bit numb and shocked because your husband just kind of left. I mean, it was just kind of over, and his family just wrote you off, this family that you felt was your family. You all of a sudden realized, oh, that was just a contract of the marriage. I guess I'm not in that family. So you seem to be orphaned in many ways from your husband leaving, his family leaving, and the loss of your own family with your mother's passing and your father's. I mean, I can only imagine how untethered you felt at this time, and that somehow the sexual addiction and the alcohol were your only grounding, like your only constant. So what led to the suicide attempt, and what was the outcome of that?
Well, I lived.
Yes, you did.
Thankfully. And looking back, I think it was clear. I had very clear signs of suicide, I guess you'd call it the suicide ideation, mm-hmm. where I would say, I just want the pain to go away forever. I wish I could just fall asleep and not wake up. This is too painful. I was driving erratically. I was involved in risky behavior, obviously, with, you know, even the sexual partners. Mm-hmm.
Bringing home strangers to your house.
Yes, and driving under the influence. And so it's now looking back, I had all those classic signs. At the time, I saw my attempt as being something impulsive, triggered by something. But really, I think it was just a slow-moving process that was going to get to that point at some point. But there was an event that really just brought me to my knees about the bleakness where I felt I had the future that I thought I had. Mm-hmm. And because I was a person that believed in forever, mm-hmm. and not wanting things to change. And I had this vision of a future, and all of a sudden that was gone. And because of the infidelity, I didn't feel like I could trust the past. And time felt like it didn't exist. And everything, all the illusions crumbled. And I took a bunch of pills, and my friend, I guess I texted her. She ended up, you know, coming to find me and brought to the hospital and then brought into the psychiatric hospital. And it was there that I realized I'm not alone here. You know, this building was not constructed just for me. And it was kind of funny that we all were shuffling away from each other, the other patients and myself.
Nobody wanted to see who else was there.
Because they were crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, I was normal and fine. I didn't belong here. They were crazy. And we laughed about that after, that we were all the same. We were people in great pain. Mm-hmm. And it got to be too much. And we attempted to make that pain go away forever. But I think any one of us is capable of getting to that point of deep pain. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to bring awareness to suicide and suicide survivors and to comfort families and friends and loved ones who have lost people to suicide. We're all capable of that. And yet it is something that we don't like to talk about. And even going, there's a study that showed that people going through separation and divorce are 3 times more likely to attempt suicide. I think that's a fairly high number.
Huge.
Is it?
Huge. It's interesting. I'm trying to not go a million different directions because your story has so many layers, but I keep thinking about how we're so woefully unprepared for loss, whether it's of a marriage or death in the family or a job or whatever that is. We're so woefully unprepared as a culture. And if our behavior is leading into it, because you talked about substance issues with your husband before the divorce even happened, you already had kind of a precedent of that numbing capacity, but not having the support system around you when the marriage fell apart, that almost ending up, it would make sense that suicide would feel like the only other option, because we do build our lives. Illusions is such a harsh way to say it, but all of our lives are just a culmination of the stories we've told ourselves are true, right? I'm married, I have children, you know, I have a job, I have this friends, that we construct that. And it can go away, and that our job in life quite often is reconstructing new realities. When our kids move away from home, we have to reconstruct our reality. When our marriage ends, we reconstruct it. And it takes a lot of energy and a lot of confidence to be able to reconstruct it. And I think one of the things you said at the beginning of the conversation was, I started as an empty vessel. Those are my words, but he said something that you started off not having that sense of self. And mm-hmm. so your marriage kind of filled you with that sense of identity, that role. And it is an identity. I mean, being a wife is a full life. And I think in order to have a healthy marriage, you have to fully embrace being married. So what you did, you know, was fully vested in the marriage. The difficulty is that when the marriage ends, you have to reconstruct. And so getting into the psychiatric ward and the help or help you didn't receive, what did that catapult you through? I mean, was at what point did you start to feel like I need to fill myself with something more than the sexual addiction and the chemical addiction? And when did that shift?
I think it shifted after being released from the psychiatric hospital. A few months after that, things started to shift where I started reading helpful books. I reconnected with my spirituality. And so I was starting to get information and started to fill myself up a little more. The volunteer projects were getting a little more busy. I was getting a little more active with that. But, you know, even then, there were times where I just felt like all that low self-worth, because I was volunteering around people who seemed so accomplished and capable, and here I was with my life falling apart and I felt worthless. But it was a really good thing for me to do. I did want to mention about, you know, these support systems and mm-hmm. being married. One thing that really surprised me at the end of the marriage was no one from our wedding, all those people who were witnesses to our vows, who I thought were there to support us in our marriage, not one of them reached out. Not one of them called. Not one of them came over. Not one of them said, "What's going on here? You guys took this vow and made this bond. How can we support you? How can we help you?" And that was really startling to me.
Well, and it's interesting because we talk about that. We've talked about another show, is that when we have a wedding, the people who are coming are not just coming to eat rubber chicken and
yes.
bring presents. They actually are signing on to say, we support this, and to at least call up and say, what the heck's going on with you? I think, again, it goes along with this unspokenness in our culture that we're all individuals, or our marriage is individual to us, that we're all so isolated that no one should butt in, right? No one should make it their business. And it's unfortunate because it's all the ways that we should butt in to help people from feeling alienated or isolated or alone. Mm-hmm. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Patty Blue Hayes. We're talking about life going through the hell of divorce, and we're going to talk about life post-divorce, and we look forward to hearing from you. 805-781-3875. We'll be back to take your calls.
Listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. It's a conversation with the reluctant therapist. Stay with us next for Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, and at 4, it's Marketplace. The number to call today to join the conversation is 805-781-3875. It's Public Radio, KCBX.
So Patty Blue Hayes, my guest today, has written a book called Wine, Sex, and Suicide, My Near-Death Divorce. It's available on Amazon. And it tells the story in journaling form about the end of her marriage and then going through, it looks like, almost 2 years of the grieving and numbing with alcohol and sexual encounters and suicide attempt, and then starting to kind of crawl up the other side. And so I want to jump a little bit from the therapeutic perspective, because as a therapist, I read the journal and I kept reading it as a case study, and I kept thinking, oh, I wish Patty had been my client, because there's so many places that I feel like we could have done some really great work. And I'm wondering, how did the mental health industry help you or not help you throughout this process, or even before the process? Because I assume you might have seen therapists at other times in your life.
Mm-hmm. I have on and off gone to seek therapy, and it is interesting. I think a lot of people assume that a therapist, a doctor, somehow has authority over us, and so we might just trust them out of trusting that they are an authority and that they have this education and that they must know something that we don't know. and that maybe they know something that's best for us. I think that I was understanding of that. My husband and I had gone to a therapist. I ended up continuing working with her and going twice a week. And at one point in the book I wrote about, I would confess to her, you know, I was just an open, I mean, I'm not going to hide anything. You know, I would tell her weekly, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And she never really told me how to stop, but she would say, oh, don't judge yourself. And while that was nice to hear, I really wanted to stop these behaviors because they were detrimental. They weren't serving me. And I do recall that being kind of like this empty void, like, okay, so I'm just supposed to go through this and continue to, you know, drink and sex myself into oblivion. And I don't know if I was capable of doing any real growth at that point. I ended up going to a psychiatrist for medications. And when one of the antidepressants didn't seem to be working well enough, there was a, you know, special frosting medication that was prescribed to reactivate and power up the original medication. And I had developed anxiety, which I'd never had in my life. I had never experienced anxiety, but I was shaking, I was vomiting, I'd lost 20 pounds. And I didn't know why. I didn't know what this word anxiety was. So there's a pill for that too. And I wasn't sleeping. Not a big surprise, but there's a pill for that as well. I didn't like that pill.
So at some point now you're taking Prozac, Xanax.
Prozac, Xanax.
Abilify.
Abilify.
Which is a heavy-duty antipsychotic.
And Trazodone had been prescribed for the sleep, which I didn't.
And you're drinking heavily in, mm-hmm. in your...
Yep.
The people prescribing these things know this.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They knew about the alcohol abuse. I mean, I really wasn't, you know, trying to hide anything because I did want to get better. I wanted to get through it. And then going into the psychiatric hospital, no one... They asked if I was under a doctor's care, but they didn't ask for the doctor's names. They didn't ask for my therapist's name. There was no contact made. And I kind of saw that experience as just being this holding tank.
Mm-hmm. The psych ward?
Yeah, it's a ward, you
like
know.
Like to detox for a couple of days and send you back out to your life?
Yeah, you have to go through the hoops to attend, you know, these group processing talks, but nobody knows you. The person who's conducting the group, they don't know your history. There's not time to know history. And you just show up and you say a few things and you put together a puzzle and you go eat meatloaf and do this cycle all over again. So it's not like there's any delving into your background from a therapeutic perspective, mm-hmm. but you're there just to stay safe, stay away from sharp objects and, you know, medications that you've taken that might have, you know, caused the near suicide.
But I'm assuming they had you continue on the medications you'd been prescribed.
I recall there were medications. I don't know exactly what they were. I'm assuming that it was what I had been taking. And I don't think I really cared at that point. But it's not a therapeutic environment, and they're not designed to be. I kind of jokingly say now, I wish I had checked into a spa or a wellness center where there was, you know, warmth and maybe some spiritual guidance and a massage and a bath and some calming music, you know, something to really nurture and support and allow you the time to process through the feelings, you know, to talk.
Which is where we kind of started the conversation with the inability to hold the grief and devastation and pain, and not trusting that you could feel the feelings and not obliterate yourself. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's what happens, is that when the feelings are so intense, the grief is so overwhelming, that we feel they will kill us if we really let them out. And so what I'm hearing is that the therapy that you received along the way is that at times in your life it could have been helpful, maybe before, you know, during the marriage, if there had been conversations in therapy about your past and your expectations going to the marriage and how to build yourself up within the marriage, it might have helped prevent it. Or is going through the divorce process, if the therapeutic experience had been more nurturing, you talked about maybe, you know, this, the music and the calming and the meditative experiences that she would have hoped for in therapy. But it sounds like you had very medically modeled experiences where we're going to get you on medications so that you don't feel the symptoms, and then we'll just say don't judge yourself until hopefully at some point you snap out of it.
There were some exercises or, you know, some things to do, but, and we had never gone for therapy before getting married because we were happy.
So there, I wish you had been my client. I would have smacked you and said, no, we all need premarital counseling.
You know,
the happiest people need premarital counseling. It helps.
Yeah, I think that would be a wonderful idea for people. But so many of us, we don't do that because we assume we're happy now, we're going to be happy forever, we'll get through things. But there are very deep, penetrating questions that can be asked, and then you get revealed answers and insight. And I know that before, when we had talked and you said, you're kind of like this classic case of, because we lived together. He moved in 4 months after we were dating, and there was this age gap where he was 7 years younger. So he was entering into his 20s and I was exiting my 20s. That's a big difference.
In life expectations and experiences, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that's part of why we delayed getting married, because just for that reason. You know, he was at the beginning of his 20s, I was at the end, and who knew what things were going to be changing for him as he went through his 20s. And then we did get married, and then not.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Patty Blue Hayes. Our number is 805-781-3875. And so I'm curious to know that, you know, as you grew through this and you did a lot of work on yourself trying to do the service. You worked in Romania for a period of time in an orphanage. You worked tutoring homeless children. You know, kind of went through the psych ward and the suicidal experience and kind of started to grow and process and come out of this. You went through a training period through Infinite Possibilities and learned new ways to cope. I mean, ultimately, the therapy had to come from within, that you had pieces of help along the way, but really without a support system of family or friends that you could really rely on, because they all fell away. It's almost as if when the divorce happened, you became a non-person to this life you had created with your husband, that you became the stranger, the outsider. So you had to ultimately do your own therapy, your own self-healing that led you to where you are now. And I'm wondering, so what is your takeaway message? I mean, what is your takeaway message to other people that are experiencing the end of a marriage or going through these dark, you know, sex and wine-driven experiences? What could have changed this for you sooner or been made it different that you want to share with other people?
I think the self-worth and self-esteem piece has a large part to do with it. And I would encourage anyone to look within to build themselves up and their self-worth and their value, because I think we place a lot of that externally and accept maybe what our partners might be telling us about ourselves, about how we're not good enough. And getting that self-esteem and self-worth going, having activities that before the marriage that you enjoyed doing, a lot of times we set aside our own interests to give in to the preferences of a partner. I would encourage women to pick up that hobby that they put down 5 years ago. You know, join a class, get a women's group together, some kind of support, a knitting circle, a meetup group, like some kind of support, friendships outside of that primary relationship. And especially if they're going through a divorce, support is critical. I don't feel that I had it. And looking back, I didn't actually even know that there were resources where I could have reached mm-hmm. out. And because of my experience, I also tell people that that support isn't necessarily going to come from the people that are closest to you, because families shift, relationships change when a divorce is imminent. Friendships that you had as a couple, those change. Even girlfriend relationships can shift and change, because everyone is having a different experience from your impending divorce or breakup.
Yeah, Bohannon talks about the six stations of divorce that we go through. And one of them is the community divorce that people don't recognize right away, that when the marriage ends, it impacts the whole community. Friends, doctors, relatives, you know, everyone that you interact with, your postman, you know, everything shifts and everyone has to realign. And I think we underestimate how much of a loss the community divorce can be if you're the person who ends up being kind of booted out of the community, and how being set adrift can be so emotionally dangerous mm-hmm. for us, right? And that's yes. where we get into the numbing and to the risky behaviors, because when we're untethered to a community, we don't have that sense of, even if we had a wonderful self-worth or sense of self-esteem, anything that pulls the rug out from under us is going to untether us. And I think that's also important, that we can have a very strong sense of self within our marriage. You know, there's a lot of people who spend a lifetime with another person who are, their identity and their self-worth is connected to that relationship. And when it works, it's a very whole and fulfilling place. But I think for people who go through divorce, all of a sudden you look at that marriage as, it was too one-sided. I only lived for the marriage. And that's really a hindsight thing, right? Because when you're within the marriage and it's working, it's like any good thing. If we're fully vested in our job, we tell people, really get vested in your job. But if the job goes away, it's the same thing. Then you'll say, well, I was too vested in the job. So I think it's important to understand that anytime something ends, we lose that sense of identity and have to recreate it. So even if we have life outside of our marriage, when the marriage ends, it's not going to prevent you from the sense of emptiness in many ways.
Right.
This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Susanna, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, yes. Hi there. First of all, I'm enjoying the conversation. I, too, have divorced. And I was the person to leave, and I was actually really surprised as well that there was no support. It was really pretty awful. I turned out to be, you know, the bad guy in all areas. But there is a loss of companionship and friendship. One of the things that I just really wanted to bring up is you do have to, you know, refine yourself and rework your identity. And I think that sometimes it is through sex and it is through having intimate relationships. And I don't think that it's necessary, you know, to label it as sexual addiction. And maybe in, you know, this woman's situation it was. But I think that there is a place to really find yourself and to find your sexual self. I was married for 20 years, and I, too, you know, had sort of a bumpy, satisfying, but, you know, sometimes not satisfying sexual life. And, you know, as a single person, all of a sudden to start to, you know, experience myself as single and dating and giving myself permission, you know, to have intimate relationships and even casual intimate relationships. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
I thank you, Susanna. And I agree. I don't think that patio is necessarily a bad thing. I think there is that transition where you have to give yourself permission to actually have a sexual relationship with someone who isn't your husband after 17 years. But then there is that fine line between discovering yourself sexually and bringing home strangers, you know, on a regular basis.
Mine was from the empty, broken place. Mine was not from, okay, I'm single and I'm going to explore my sexuality. Mine was a compulsion to fill an empty void of feeling worthless as a woman.
Well, and I think also if you're feeling worse after the experiences than filled, I think that's also a critical difference.
Well, that's interesting because I actually, it would satisfy the fix. Mm-hmm. So I felt good afterwards, but I didn't want them around.
Right. So it wasn't building a new relationship.
No,
sexual
it was just, yeah.
Anne, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to make, number one, this is a really incredible conversation. I just wanted to say thank you to this very brave woman who wrote this. This is really incredible. The other thing is that I went through a situation, I just wanted to comment about the use of the drugs when you were in counseling and the alcohol, because I went through a situation where I had a husband to whom I'm still married now, no divorce, but he went away on a dangerous job that I didn't want him to go on. And while he was gone on this very, it was in the Middle East, this very dangerous job, I got incredibly depressed and I was self-medicating with alcohol. Well, the psychologist that I went to referred me to a psychiatrist, and they both knew everything about the alcohol, but they wanted me to go on these antidepressants. The end result was that I was on antidepressants, which made me feel absolutely fine about all the drinking I was doing and the fact that I was not going to work and fulfilling my career.
Mm.
So, you know, that it was like, yeah, drink a lot. They said, oh, no, don't drink while you're taking these, but instead, the feeling was, I'm okay. You know, I think that the drugs were detrimental in that sense. So I just wanted to contribute that and say thank you again for sharing this information. I just think this is an amazing journey and a lot of people can relate to it.
Thank you so much, Anne. And I appreciate your thoughts about, you know, when we go in seeking help, because I come from that therapeutic place, that I'm concerned that if we do blindly go in and just entrust the experts with our mental health and well-being, that it's not always going to be in our best interest, because we're the only ones who know our whole story, that in some ways we have to be our own advocate when we're seeking mental health support and to be able to say, I am coming to you because I am doing these behaviors that I want to stop. Right? We have to be able to articulate to the professional what our goals are and not just hand ourselves over and say, fix me, I'm hurting, because it's a lot to ask another individual just to fix. And so I encourage anyone who's going through times of great depression or loss, when you seek therapy, which can be so helpful and important and life-saving, to have some goals that you walk in and say, here's what's happening in my life and I want to get to this other place, that it'll change the course of your therapeutic experience if you can walk in and articulate where you need to go. And I think we're not always encouraged to do that because we're never taught how to go to therapy. It's another lesson, like feeling feelings. I mean, this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Patty, I want to thank you for coming in and sharing your story today. Patty Blue Hayes' book, Wine, Sex, and Suicide, My Near-Death Divorce, is available on Amazon. She's here in San Luis Obispo.